It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk about three new Wisconsin laws that are designed to help fight the opioid crisis by targeting fentanyl in particular. First, Wisconsin Senators Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin introduced a bill to delist the gray wolf from federal protection. The bill comes just weeks after a California federal court ruled that the gray wolf should be protected under the Endangered Species Act in states including Wisconsin. Senator Baldwin in a statement says, quote, "This bipartisan legislation is the best solution because it's driven by science." Senator Johnson in a statement said Wisconsinites must have a say in the management of gray wolves. Both agree that decisions surrounding the wolves should be made at the state level. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Should the federal courts determine the protection status of the gray wolf? Do you think wolves should continue to stay protected in the state? Do you support the idea of taking them off the endangered species list? Do you have questions about what this all means for wolf hunting here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Adrian Wideven is a retired forest wildlife biologist. He's now the chair of the Timber Wolf Alliance Advisory Council and a volunteer with Wisconsin's Green Fire. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to you about this, Adrian, for years now, this back and forth, delisted, back on the list, and so on. What is the current status of the gray wolf here in Wisconsin for people who are feeling a little whiplash here?
Well, currently, as a federally listed species, they are on the federal endangered species list. If this bill goes through by Senator Baldwin and Senator Johnson, they would be removed from the endangered species list. I should point out that the bill that Senator Baldwin and Senator Johnson are proposing is a reaffirming of the 2011 delisting of wolves in the Western Great Lakes. So this would not be a delisting of wolves across the rest of the lower 48 states, as this court case that had recently been held in California. But currently they are a federally endangered species. The state of Wisconsin lists them as a game species with a closed season.
And that has meant that when wolves were off the endangered species list for a while, not only could wolves be hunted in Wisconsin, there had to be a hunt because of legislation in Wisconsin. Can you talk about wolf management when the Endangered Species Act isn't relevant for the Wisconsin gray wolf?
Yeah, in previous delistings in 2007, 2009, the DNR, the state did not have a wolf hunting season, and it just meant that there was more flexibility by the state for managing the wolf populations. But in 2011, the Wisconsin legislature created a bill, which was finalized in 2012 after wolves were delisted the third time. And it required the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to hold a wolf hunting season anytime they're not on the federal or state endangered and threatened species list, which means that anytime they're delisted, then they automatically are a hunted species and the DNR is required to hold a wolf hunting season. And last year we had this incident where wolves were removed from the endangered species list in January of 2021. The DNR had hoped to wait until fall of 2021 to hold its wolf hunting season, but because of legal actions by a group that wanted to hold a wolf hunt yet that winter, the DNR was forced to hold a wolf hunting season in February of 2021. And the department had set a quota of 119 wolves for that harvest, and was over-harvested by 218 wolves, in part because of it was in the middle of the breeding season. It allowed full use of dogs, which had not been previously allowed. And so it ended up being a very aggressive wolf hunt. And those are the situations right now that once wolves are off the endangered species list, there's a possibility a hunt could again be forced on the department anytime it's between the first Saturday of November until the end of February. The department potentially can hold a wolf hunting season.
Based on the wolf numbers here in Wisconsin, their habitat here in the state, Adrian, do you think they should be protected by the Federal Endangered Species Act here in the state, or should it be left to the state to manage now?
Well, the population biologically has certainly recovered. We're at well over 1,000 wolves in Wisconsin, or at least we're at the last survey that was completed in 2021 prior to the February 2021 wolf hunt, suggesting a fairly healthy population. And for the Great Lakes region, with Michigan and Minnesota, we have about 4,500 wolves. So biologically, it is a population that can be managed by the states. Unfortunately, because of the nature of the wolf hunting season that we've had imposed on Wisconsin DNR by the legislature, it's limited the ability of the Wisconsin DNR on managing the wolf population. Not that the department is going to cause the wolf population again become endangered, but it causes things like these this February wolf hunt of 2021 to be a possibility. It reduces the effectiveness of the department for managing the wolf population. So biologically, they probably are a species the state can manage. Unfortunately, some of the politics are not very supportive of sound wolf conservation.
Talking to wildlife biologist Adrian Wideven about gray wolves in Wisconsin, back and forth on the endangered species list and enforcement here in the state. Right now, those wolves in Wisconsin are protected under the Federal Endangered Species Act after a court ruling earlier this year. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Let's go to a caller now. Kurt is with us in Mountain. Kurt, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Kurt?
Well, I just feel that that should be done by the state, because last year with that hunt, within 3 days, we already killed off their population or their quota. And I live in rural Wisconsin, and we do have a wolf issue up here. The deer population has plummeted along with some of the other wildlife, and I've had them right up in around my house, and I have livestock, and I just think it needs to have a little better control done on it on a state level and not the federal level.
Kurt, thanks for the call. Adrian, a common concern, especially in rural Wisconsin, wolves as a threat to livestock.
That is more of a concern. We do have depredations on livestock across parts of Wisconsin, especially in northern parts of Douglas County, some parts of central Wisconsin. But we're talking generally of only about 15% of wolf packs in the state that are causing depredation on livestock. So it's a relatively small percentage of the population that are involved in that. And the surveys the DNR has been doing on the deer population, we don't see on any kind of regional-wide or even county-wide basis a drastic reduction in the deer population. Certainly, there may be pockets of areas where the population may have been reduced somewhat, but on a regional-wise or even county-wide basis, the deer herd is doing quite well. And I'm not sure what other species are being negatively impacted by wolves, except perhaps coyotes in the middle of wolf territories. And for most part, I think coyote populations are very healthy in Wisconsin, so that's not really an issue.
Kurt, thanks for that call. For that case where you've got a particular wolf eating people's livestock, what are options for control there under the current situation, under the Endangered Species Act protections?
Well, right now, all the options would be non-lethal controls. So that would be various sorts of exclusions, fencing. A favorite activity or one that works often are a technique called fladry, where flagging is hung around the outside of a pasture. And for some reason, wolves often see that as kind of a barrier and don't readily cross the fladry or this flagging hanging across a pasture. Noise devices can be set up that can play a wide variety of noises, people yelling, helicopters going off, explosion noises, and it that can be very fearful for wolves and cause them to avoid areas. Flashing lights at times can be very useful. For sheep, guard dogs are very useful. So there are a variety of non-lethal methods, but any kind of lethal controls would not be authorized currently.
Thanks for that call. Bruce joins us now in Albany. Bruce, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Way back when Wisconsin was looking at reintroducing wolves, there were studies and analysis, et cetera, that was done. And it was pretty well accepted amongst the conservationists and that the carry capacity for Wisconsin would be best at its high point to be around 350 animals. Now we're way, way over that. People are seeing the consequences of that. Everywhere with livestock, domestic animals, et cetera. And I think that a lot of people don't understand that that was meant to be around the peak or the maximum rather than a benchmark that has to be maintained. And we can't possibly go under that number.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Adrian, is that right, that 350 was at one point the high, the maximum? And if so, why has that changed?
Well, actually, Bruce has a couple of misconceptions there. There was never a plan to reintroduce wolves into Wisconsin. Wolves moved here on their own when they were given federal and state endangered species protections in the mid-1970s. The animals from the Minnesota population, as they were protected, start spreading eastward and moved into Wisconsin. So that's how wolves arrived here. And the 350 was not an original plan. That grew out of the 1999 wolf plan. In 1980, when wolves were first moving into the state, our best guess is the state could only hold about 150 wolves. So 350 was the number that was used in the 99 plan. At the time, there were about 200 wolves in Wisconsin. And at the time, our estimates were that the carrying capacity was about 500 wolves. But the most recent estimates suggest that the carrying capacity is actually about 1,240 wolves. And so we know the state can hold more wolves than what our earlier estimates were. So 350, while it was a suitable goal in 1999, is no longer a suitable goal for Wisconsin wolf population.
Thanks for that call. And also the idea that everybody has seen wolf, at least concerns, if not depredations, threatening livestock and domestic animals. How widespread are those things?
Generally, from on average year, about 30 farms suffer some depredations from livestock. The highest number we ever had was 47 in 2010, but it's come down since then. It came down quite drastically during the previous delisting between 2012 and 2014, where it came down to just 22, 23 farms. Then it started going up again when the state lost some of that management authority. In recent years, it's been kind of hovering around 25, 30 farms that have some depredation problems each year. There are some farms that just have an occasional wolf passing through, creating some concerns, but not causing any actual depredations. But the actual depredations are usually, about a couple of dozen farms or so.
We're talking about gray wolves in Wisconsin, currently receiving protection, federal protection under the Endangered Species Act. A bill introduced by Senators Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson would end that again. Adrian Weideven stays with us, longtime forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timber Wolf Alliance Advisory Council. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want the gray wolf to be permanently delisted under the Endangered Species Act, or at least exempted from it here in Wisconsin? Should the state be managing this as opposed to the federal government? Do you think we should have a wolf hunt in the state? Do you have questions or concerns about a wolf depredation of livestock or domestic animals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Adrian Weideven, retired wildlife biologist and current chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, about a bill that would delist wolves from federal protection here in Wisconsin weeks after the gray wolf was relisted as a federally protected animal under a court ruling. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on all that and your questions. Back to your calls now. Kate is with us in Madison. Kate, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to thank the DNR person for sharing some information, and just to, reiterate for listeners that all the sort of understanding of wolf population, it's all speculative. These surveys are not comprehensive, and the biologists or ecologists are just kind of picking the population set point. The state could probably hold many more wolves, and I think that it should be a federal issue. I mean, obviously these wolves don't obey state lines. It's ridiculous to try to, think that one state can manage them, and once they cross some invisible boundary that the wolf isn't going to know that, then they're going to be, up for to be killed. And the hunt that happened last year, I think, just illustrates that when it is under state management, it can be undermined immediately by these outside hunters' rights groups or whoever is, so eager to kill wolves.
Kate, thanks for the call. To clarify, Adrian, you used to be with the DNR. You're not with them now. We're speaking for the DNR. But what did you think of what Kate had to say?
Well, certainly, there's the understanding by many people that federal listing is preferred because they don't want to see hunting seasons. And that is a possibility that when state management takes over, that hunting seasons are a possibility. But I think states can manage wildlife species. And for the most part, in Wisconsin, the recovery work in the state was mostly done by DNR people. And I think they did have fairly comprehensive wolf surveys, and the estimates of the potential carrying capacity were based on the best available science at the time. So I think the states can manage wolves. The biggest problem I think we're seeing in recent times are that we're seeing too much political interference with the state management of wildlife population. We're having it now in Wisconsin, but certainly is a problem too in Idaho and Montana, where there's attempts to aggressively control wolf populations. The scientists and wildlife managers working with wolves for the state agencies, I think, are very much in favor of maintaining healthy, viable populations. We just need to get more of the politics out of wolf management.
Okay, thanks for that call. Lisa joins us next in Toma. Lisa, hello.
Yes, I'm in Toma now, but I live up in Marinette County, and we have wolves up there, and I have seen them on my property, but I have never once had a problem with them with my livestock. But I've had to, in the 8 years we've been up there, I've had to chase coyotes away from my goats 3 times. But the deer, the wolves have never been a problem. I think people complain about the deer population being less, but they're not less. If you're actually out in the woods on a regular basis, you see them. They just keep them moving, and they keep the population healthy because they get rid of the sick and weak.
Lisa, thanks for the call. A couple points there. Let's tackle that second one first, Adrian. Wolves as part of the ecosystem, maintaining a healthy deer herd.
Sure. There's a lot of evidence accumulating on the benefits of wolves to the ecosystems that they, one of the things we've seen in Wisconsin, there's reduction in vehicle collisions in those counties that have wolf populations, that we're seeing a healthier diversity of wildflowers in the middle of wolf pack areas. We're seeing less heavy browsing on tree seedlings in the middle of wolf pack areas. Wolves have some impact on coyotes, as Lisa hinted at, that they may reduce overabundance of coyotes, and coyotes can be a very important predator and fawns. On a per square mile basis, coyotes probably kill more deer than wolves do. Wolves are probably one of the factors that helps reduce the spread of chronic wasted disease into our deer herd. So there are many ways that wolves really provide ecological benefits on the landscape.
Thanks for calling in, talking about gray wolves in Wisconsin, how they're managed, who manages them. Adrian Wideven stays with us. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. John is with us next in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I want to ask, why does the state continue to pay for dogs that are injured or killed by wolves, especially the bear hunters who take their dogs out and run them during the season when wolves have their young and so forth? It doesn't make any sense to me.
John, thanks for the call. Adrian, is that something that happens?
It does. Yeah, Wisconsin is the only state that does pay for dogs that are killed in hunting situations. And the dogs we're talking about are mainly hound dogs used for training on bears in July and August, or used for hunting bears in September, early part of October. This is also the time period that wolves are at their summer rendezvous sites and protecting their pups. So it's mainly how these are occurring. But I should point out there's probably a benefit in those payment programs. It probably reduces illegal killing of wolves. It gives the hunters another alternative when they're very angry because they lost a dog to wolf to do something different than try to kill wolves and instead have to call a federal agent to investigate their depredation. It pays for an agent to go and carefully examine whether the dog was killed, which pack was involved. So we get a lot of useful data from that. And I think we probably reduce illegal killing of wolves by providing this benefit, this payment program.
Amy, thanks for calling in. Carolyn joins us now in Menominee Falls. Carolyn, hello.
Yeah, actually, I was curious, is there a site to go to in which you can find out the latest data on how many gray wolves are in your county? For instance, we have property up in do know and would be interested. And I think enough was said about higher level predation being good for the ecology. You spoke very well about that, but I wanted to add that comment.
Carolyn, thanks for the call. Adrian, are we tracking county by county our wolf numbers?
The DNR used to list packs by counties, and some of those older reports are still available online. The DNR has an excellent site with lots of information on wolf biology, the management of wolves, the latest reports on the wolf counts. You can see maps in there that will show where wolves are distributed across the state. So while you can't get exact counts for each county, you can see these maps, and based on the regions that wolves are being surveyed, you can probably come up with a rough estimate for most counties of how many of those wolves are occurring within your county.
Thanks for that call, Carolyn. In our last minute or so, Adrian, I know the DNR is looking at long-term wolf management plans. So are there peers in our neighboring states? Is that hard to do given that things keep shifting from federal to state and so on? What kind of things can they be considering now?
Certainly those add some complexity, but there's lots of scientific information that has been updated since the last completed wolf plan in 99. There was a minor modification to it in 2007, but there's a lot of new things that we've learned about wolves, including the things I mentioned about some of the ecological impacts and our best assessment of carrying capacity. So certainly the department can update its plans for how it's going to manage its wolf population into the near future when they are listed and when they're not a listed species. And there's certainly a lot of things that can be done there. And I should point out the department will be probably coming up with a draft plan sometime this spring. So people should be looking for that and for opportunities to comment on that draft plan. And there will be opportunities on the conservation hearings on April 11th to comment on what you believe the wolf population goal should be, whether 350 is adequate, and whether hunting with hounds is an appropriate way to hunt wolves. So people will have opportunity to comment on those things on April 11th at the state conservation hearings.
Adrian, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Rob.
Adrian Weidevin is a retired forest wildlife biologist, current chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council. We talked to them about a bill introduced by Senators Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin to delist gray wolves from the endangered species list in the Great Lakes region. They were put back on the list in a recent court ruling. Coming up after the news, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says synthetic opioids like fentanyl were the main driver of overdose deaths in 2020. We'll talk with an emergency physician about how three new laws fit into a larger effort to handle this crisis in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the internet has made it easier than ever for one person to speak to thousands, even millions of other people. But how does that affect our democracy? We'll talk to the author of the new book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Now, Governor Evers was in La Crosse last week to sign a series of bills related to the synthetic opioid fentanyl after those bills passed in the state legislature. One of them decriminalizes testing strips that help identify the drug in other substances with the goal of preventing further overdoses. Here's Evers speaking last week, just to know that he may sound a bit muffled by a face mask.
While promoting safe and responsible use, we're helping ensure folks to keep themselves and others safe by using testing strips to identify if a substance is laced with fentanyl before even taking it.
We're going to talk about how these laws fit into the larger scope of what the state is doing to try to stem the opioid and overdose crises that have picked up during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does this story affect you? Have you or someone you know had any experience with opioid addiction or overdose that you would be comfortable sharing with us? Has this become a problem for your community during the pandemic? Do you work with people dealing with opioid addiction? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician with Gunderson Health System, medical director for Tri-State Ambulance, and medical advisor for Region 4 for the Wisconsin Healthcare Coalition. Dr. Eberlein, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for having me today.
Before we get into these newest laws, these newest efforts, can you talk about the problem with opioids and overdoses? At least according to national numbers, things seem to be getting worse.
Yeah, we've seen this trend over the course of the pandemic. Unfortunately, it's really hit us pretty hard in the last year and a half. Locally, we were seeing a little bit of improvement right before the pandemic hit, but the pandemic didn't really help with anything, as we all know. So that has definitely taken a backward step on our on the numbers that we're seeing, and causing us to elevate our response a little bit more.
From what we know, is this a case where more people are addicted to opioids now, or is the bigger problem here with overdoses that we're seeing more very dangerous fentanyl showing up in drugs that people are using?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's a little of both. Mm. I think that we did see some more people turn to opiates for self-medicating themselves for depression and issues from the pandemic. And then you couple that with the increase in fentanyl in our communities, which is quite frankly so deadly and dangerous that has really fueled the opioid deaths.
I want to get into these new laws now passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. First, the one we just heard about, testing strips for fentanyl or similar synthetic drugs. They will no longer be considered illegal drug paraphernalia. Can you talk about how this would work in practice?
Sure. So currently, prior to this, there was no legal way that you could test what you had, what you're about to take to check it for fentanyl. And so it was really, quite frankly, a gamble. And so with the increase in fentanyl in our communities, someone would go out and they would buy a drug. Let's say they were purchasing heroin. If fentanyl was in there, you know, it's 100 to 1,000 times more potent than heroin was. And so they could easily overdose. In addition, if someone was buying like oxycodone pills over on the street, you know, we know there has been a few tragic stories of teenagers purchasing these for a party and then not knowing it was fentanyl and having a fatal overdose. So this would allow someone to actually test that substance for fentanyl and see if fentanyl's in there. And that would hopefully change their usage, either hopefully not use at all, but at least if they were going to continue to use, they would either have someone there available with Narcan and reduce the dose that they were going to use.
And just to really hammer this home, somebody who thinks they're taking the heroin, say that they've taken previously, might have a vision of what kind of dose is safe for them. If there's fentanyl, that just totally throws the scale out of whack and makes that overdose and overdose death much more likely. Do I have that right?
You are absolutely correct.
Now, another law has to do with penalties related to making or distributing fentanyl, in particular, having it with the intent of doing either of those things. Do you see this as an important step in law, clarifying, I think, enhancing the penalties for that drug?
Yeah, I think so. It always did surprise me that fentanyl was in a category that wasn't as serious as heroin for law enforcement. And so this evens that playing field. So this puts it at that same category. So there's increasing penalties for manufacturing, dealing, and possession of fentanyl. And so hopefully this would help. You know, this is such an overall difficult problem and so multifaceted that you need so many angles to work on reducing overdose deaths. And law enforcement continues to be one of those areas. And this will support that.
And then the third new piece of legislation, setting up a database for cataloging the use of opioids, as well as methamphetamine, a big problem in many communities as well. How important is this kind of data collection to getting a grip on the problem?
You know, I actually think that this is probably one of them that in the end may be incredibly important. In fact, it may end up being one of the most important because currently there's not a good tracking system to know if they're supposed, you know, so let's say we typically in La Crosse see our overdoses increase 1 to 2 weeks after Milwaukee's. And so there's not a great mechanism for me to be able to track that currently. And this real-time database with analytics would help us to start to see trends across the state and hopefully have more ability to do some preventive measures through public health to hopefully cut these off and eliminate the overdose deaths from that angle as well. And so, it will include methamphetamines, which is good because we continue to see that in our toxicology reports from those that have died from overdoses. That has been an ongoing issue. It doesn't get always as much press because sometimes it's a secondary drug, but it is still a problem as well. So it's nice to see that's in there too.
Talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician at Gunderson Health System, looking at the opioid epidemic, fentanyl overdoses, some new laws in the state trying to help turn the tide on that. Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Brooke is with us in Eau Claire. Brooke, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So I really wanted to touch base on having treatment centers talk about post-acute withdrawal syndrome and what methadone actually does for patients. I have a significant other who has recently stopped taking methadone and had to go back on from dealing with post-acute withdrawal syndrome. And I feel like methadone and Suboxone are totally different, and we don't warn the patients about the difference in these substances and how their body and mind get so addicted to it. And post-acute withdrawal syndrome is not talked about at all for addiction.
Brooke, thanks a lot for calling in. Best to your acquaintance who's dealing with this. Dr. Eberlein, can you talk about methadone and Suboxone in treatment and concerns, as Brooke was saying, about what happens if and when you stop those?
Yeah, you know, these drugs are always need to be closely monitored, and part of a program for opiate addiction and treatment. I by no means am an expert in the treatment of long-term treatment of opiate use disorder as an ER physician, but we do treat the acute withdrawal with buprenorphine in the ER, and methadone, it's a very, very long-acting opiate, and so how they use that is you get a daily dose, and they can slowly titrate you off that. But clearly, if the dosing is not correct, or if the titration is too fast, people will go into a withdrawal syndrome. And so that's why it's so important with any of these drugs to really work closely with your healthcare provider to get that the formulation correct and the treatment you need correct. This is not a one size fits all for every patient. And that is why that communication and working with your physician is just so important with this, because there are many layers to this, you know, not only mental health, but the physical addiction and dependency. So once again, you know, for all those that are struggling with addiction, continue to work with your healthcare providers. They're getting more tools and better understanding all the time.
Brooke, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Eberlein, when you've treated that patient who comes in that acute crisis moment after an overdose, they survive, hopefully. Do you have any confidence that they're going to be able to get the kind of services they need, whether that's methadone, Suboxone, the mental health care you were mentioning, and so on?
It's always a challenge. And we've been expanding treatment availability throughout the state over the last several years. Are we to the point where we need to be yet? Absolutely not. You know, we've seen a steady increase in the need for mental health services. How much of that had to do with the pandemic? It's hard to tell yet. But we are clearly in need of ongoing mental health resources throughout, not just our state, but nationwide. This is not an isolated issue. And we are going to continue to need increased capacity in these areas.
We're talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician with Gunderson Health System. We're looking at the fight against opioid overdoses in Wisconsin. Three bills passed the legislature, signed by the governor, that target fentanyl in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on those new laws, questions about how they work? Is this part of your life right now? Have you dealt with addiction, or maybe someone close to you worried about overdoses, worried about the presence of fentanyl and other synthetic opioid drugs showing up in local supplies? Or do you work on the healthcare side of things, or are you a first responder? What kind of things are you seeing in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician with Gunderson Health System, medical director for Tri-State Ambulance, and medical advisor for Region 4 for the Wisconsin Healthcare Coalition. We're talking about three new laws that Governor Evers signed, passed by the legislature, aimed at reducing the deadly influence of the synthetic opioid fentanyl and similar drugs here in Wisconsin and the wider opioid crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your personal experience. Let's go back to your calls now. Jason is with us in Beaver Dam. Jason, hi.
Hi, sir. I was just calling to say that I've had three back surgeries, 2005, 2010, 2016, and I was on very heavy medication from the doctors, and then I was put on methadone. I was on methadone for almost 10 years, and at the maximum, I was up to 270 milligrams a day. I got off on my, I quit on my own. I weaned myself down until I thought I could quit. And when I finally got off of it, I barely slept for almost, it was a couple months.
Wow. Without,
well, I barely slept. And I would, by the time I regained that ability to sleep, I still never felt right. And it was about a year and a half later, just recently, a few months ago, I went on Suboxone because I still couldn't feel normal. And it's like you're feeding your body something artificial for so long that it stops producing it naturally. And I guess if I had a question, it would be, does your body ever start to regain that after so many years?
Jason, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing that. Good luck to you as you are still dealing with this. Dr. Eberlein, you mentioned you're not an expert in this stage of the opioid problem, but what thoughts do you have for Jason and his story?
Yeah, sure. My thoughts are with him. Chronic pain is so difficult to treat, and we are still learning a lot about the impact of these drugs long-term on the body and on the receptors. Thought is that eventually these receptors can recover. Obviously, it's going to be different for everyone, but the thought and hope is that eventually we can get people back to their baseline and back to a normal state. And hopefully with his Suboxone use now that he can continue to function and do well.
Jason, thanks a lot for calling in. Good luck to you. We'll go to Gene now in Stevens Point. Gene, hi.
Hi, I have a question. I'm wondering why the people who are selling these drugs are choosing to cut their drugs with fentanyl. Because it's such a powerful drug, I would think it would be more expensive. Is it easier for them to get their hands on, or what is the reason that they're choosing to use the fentanyl to cut?
Gene, thanks for the call. As I understand it, one reason, Dr. Eberlein, that these synthetic opioids are big is because they're synthetic. There doesn't need to be a crop involved in it. Can you talk about why this stuff is showing up in drug supplies?
For sure. I think it's purely economics. She brings up a very good point, because on the surface, you'd think that this may hurt your business and it would be more difficult, but it's actually the opposite. With heroin, you need a whole poppy field, and it's very easily noticed by satellites, law enforcement. They can destroy these fields. What we've seen is a shift from heroin to fentanyl because, as you mentioned, you make these in a lab, so they can mass produce this drug, often overseas. And then when you think about the need and difficulty of smuggling a substance in, so if you've got something that's up to 1,000 times more potent, that's 1,000 times less volume you have to smuggle into the country. And so it makes all aspects of this drug trade easier. The manufacturing is simpler because you don't have the crops, and the actual distribution of it is simpler because it's a much smaller quantity that you need to move.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about opioid drugs, especially synthetic opioids like fentanyl, with Dr. Chris Eberlein from Gunderson Health System, emergency physician there. Still time for your calls with your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Eberlein, her question reminds me why we had fentanyl in the first place. My understanding is there was a legitimate use for it originally, mainly for people in extreme pain with things, for example, like a very advanced forms of cancer.
Yeah. And you know, this is a drug that is very commonly used in the healthcare setting because it actually has a great, when you're monitored appropriately and you know exactly the dose that you're giving, such as in a hospital, it is a fantastic drug for acute pain. We use it in trauma, we use it in surgery, areas that you are in extreme, that you would be in extreme pain otherwise. So these are the areas that we use it in. And so it's a great tool in a physician and surgeon anesthesiologist toolbox. But in the setting, when you're not monitored, you don't know the dose, it is incredibly dangerous just because of its potency.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bill is with us calling from the Northwoods. Bill, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. What a remarkable topic. Yeah, it's something that on the other side of the scale, that there's the over policing basically of the people that are in chronic pain that need, you know, pain medication to help them, can't get it, and they're into like a palliative care situation that there's basically physicians, and the new pain route is doing epidural injections because they're making thousands of dollars per treatment versus writing out a prescription. And it's really just not fair because people are so desperate. That's what they're doing. That's why I feel the overdoses are high, because they are hitting the streets because they can't get anything for pain.
Bill, thanks for sharing that. An important perspective, Dr. Eberlein, concerned that people who do need opioid medications, now there's a reluctance to prescribe them.
Yeah, and this is something that I think we've been trying to be very careful about, is that you continue to treat people's pain. And recently the CDC loosened up a little bit some of the recommendations on at least on the draft that I saw, some of the wording on prescription opioids. You still need to treat pain for, there are some people that are going to need pain medications to treat their pain. So clearly we have to make sure that the pendulum doesn't swing so far that we're not treating patients appropriately. What we really need to do is find that middle ground where patients are getting their pain treated and hopefully the cause of their pain treated, because the reality is the pain medication isn't fixing anything. It's covering up something that is wrong in the body. And so if we can get to the point where we can actually fix the problem, whether that be with physical therapy, acupuncture, I mean, there's lots of other modalities to treat pain. That's ideal, but you will have some patients that will need opiate pain medications to function. And that's the conversation that with your pain specialist and your doctor, that's really important to have. So that way, by no means we want people to suffer.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Eberlein, you're an emergency room physician. You see people coming in with these overdose crises. What, in your mind, would be the biggest help for you, whether that's resources or changes in state or federal law or fill in the blank? What would help you do your job?
Yeah, you know, we've made steady progress on this over the last few years. This new set of bills will be helpful. I'm really looking forward to the database to be able to know what's in the community, when the spikes are coming, that could alter our response on EMS as well. So that real-time data will be very helpful. Continuing to treat this complex problem with treatment programs, in ongoing Narcan availability. You know, it's always a concern of mine. You know, a lot of the Narcan that's out in our communities that's saving lives every day is dependent on government grants, like the Narcan Direct program. If that money went away, it would be a huge impact. And I think we'd see a massive spike in overdose deaths because people aren't gonna go out and spend $80 for a pack of Narcan. Education, this is not there's not one single fix to this. We really need this comprehensive plan. And I think we're starting to hit more angles on it. And hopefully in the next few years, we continue to see improvement. But it, you know, this was a long time coming, and this problem built up over years. It's going to take years to correct it as well.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Eberlein, thanks again for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician with Gunderson Health System. He joined us today for a look at Wisconsin's fight against opioid abuse and overdoses and how a trio of new laws targeting fentanyl in particular fit into that overall effort. Want to remind anyone who might be looking for substance use treatment and recovery services, you can dial 211 for the Wisconsin Addiction Recovery Helpline. That's free. It's available 24/7. Again, that number, 211 for the Wisconsin Addiction Recovery Helpline. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, housing prices have gone up in many places around Wisconsin. That's making it hard for people to live in the communities where they work. You can find out about a new statewide effort to boost workforce housing around Wisconsin. You can join in with your story. Start right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. That conversation's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. What's cool? The Northern Lights. As we learned yesterday on the show, we found out the best ways to have a chance of seeing the Northern Lights, aka Aurora Borealis, here in Wisconsin. What happens when you shoot some rockets through the Northern Lights? Well, we might find out tomorrow. NASA is planning to launch a couple of rockets tomorrow night to fly through the Northern Lights. On the one hand, this sounds like the kind of science experiment I might have come up with back in junior high. But there is some actual science going on here. They're trying to figure out how the aurora interacts with Earth's atmosphere. The rockets are going to have lots of sensors that track what's going on in the Northern Lights, temperature, density, the basics, plus they'll leave a vapor path to show which way the wind is blowing. Are we going to see footage, live or recorded? I hope so. This is Central Time.